Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Monica Brady-Meyerov, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. It's a new era in Iraq today. After 7 years of war, $1 trillion spent, 4,400 American lives lost, and more than 100,000 Iraqi deaths, Vice President Joe Biden is in Iraq today. He's attended a ceremony marking the formal end of American combat operations.
After all that Iraq has endured, we understand their deeply felt desire to control their own lives, determine their own fate, and maintain their own security.
50,000 American troops will stay on to advise and assist Iraqi security forces. And in his Oval Office address last night, President Obama said America is not abandoning Iraq.
As our military draws down, our dedicated civilians, diplomats, aid workers, and advisors are moving into the lead to support Iraq as it strengthens its government, resolves political disputes, resettles those displaced by war, and builds ties with the region and the world.
Today, we're going to hear from people who fought in the war and lost loved ones there. June Davis of Grand Rapids, Michigan, lost her son, Private First Class Billy Davis, back in 2007, when a roadside bomb exploded beneath the Humvee he was driving in Iraq. He left behind a wife and two children. Thanks for joining us, June.
Hi.
June, what was your reaction to President Obama's speech last night? He said it was the end of combat operations in Iraq, and he also said he was awed by the sacrifice of those men and women who've died.
Well, it's all fine and dandy, but the war has not ended. Now we're going to have to really watch what's going to go on over here. Thank God our boys are going to be safe now. They're going to be back in America.
Not all the troops are back. 50,000 American troops are staying behind in Iraq.
It makes me feel awful. And look how many have been lost and how many more are going to be lost because they're not coming home. They need to come back.
There's the concern that violence is escalating in Iraq and political instability continues since the country has failed to form a new government, and that American withdrawal will lead to Iraq falling back into sectarian violence.
Well, you know, the thing people have to understand is we were over there for violence in the first place. This violence is not going to end with these people. My son was shot, blown up in 4 months. He didn't have a chance.
Do you think his service was in vain?
I think that they were young boys. I mean, they went over there proud, thinking they were going to save their country. They didn't know they were going to get blown up. They seriously didn't.
You said you wished he'd bring the troops home where they can help Americans here. And last night, the president did focus a lot of his speech on home, on America and the economy and the work that needs to be done to create jobs. What are your feelings on that, living in Michigan, which has been one of the hardest areas hit by the recession?
Well, before, my understanding was, listening to my grandma Busha and all the old people, is that you used to have wars to get you out of the economy crisis, but this war has definitely taken us down. We need to protect America so our economy is strong again and we have jobs and we don't have to worry about any more boys getting killed. You know, you never get over it. They always say, you know, when does a mother quit worrying about her children? You never quit worrying about your children. Even though my son is in the ground and that, I still worry about him.
And I hear some kids in the background. Is that Billy's child?
Yeah. He had a little girl that was 3, and she's very messed up today. She doesn't understand death. And 2 weeks after he died, he had a boy, and he's 3 today.
What's his name?
Caden. Caden Andrew William Davis.
Well, June Davis, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
June Davis of Grand Rapids, Michigan. Her son, Private First Class Billy Davis, died while serving in Iraq. Joining us in the studio now is Seth Moulton. He's a former Marine captain who went on 4 tours of duty in Iraq and worked for General David Petraeus. And Seth, obviously an emotional perspective from June Davis. She said the war is not over. She was talking about the war against terrorists, but is the war in Iraq over?
No, I don't think that it is, and I wish that it were, but the rising violence we've seen just in the past few weeks is an indication that even the military component of the war is not done. And obviously the continued and very significant stalemate in the Iraqi political process shows that we have an awful lot of work to do still on the political front.
And in June Davis's mind, she says the U.S. needs to get all Americans out of Iraq now. What do you think?
I think that's dangerous. I think that even withdrawing all our troops in a year from now is dangerous. You know, Iraq, for all the mistakes that led to the start of the war, for all the mistakes that Americans and Iraqis have made since the war began, there's still a great chance that Iraq could succeed. And I think that we can all recognize that having a functioning democracy, a democratic ally in the Middle East, would be good for the region and good for America's interests in the regions.
And by keeping on troops to advise and assist Iraqi forces, do you think that will help to keep the country from falling backwards?
Well, I think that it might be necessary at this point, and we just have to be very careful about doing the withdrawal responsibly. You know, President Obama said last night that the withdrawal from Afghanistan would be conditions-based. He would withdraw two troops based on the progress on the ground. And I'm not sure why that should suddenly not apply to Iraq as well.
There's been a lot of talk about the surge. Many Republicans have reminded President Obama that he was against it, but that he wouldn't be in this position to draw down troops if there hadn't been a surge. Do you think that helped to get us to the point where we are today?
Oh, absolutely. The surge was a huge success, and it's absolutely responsible for the incredible turnaround in security and in the opportunity that we now have in Iraq. But the work of the surge is not finished. I mean, violence still plagues the country, and the second point is that the military surge was supposed to be followed by a diplomatic surge. And the stalemate in Iraqi politics right now, I think, shows that that either hasn't happened or it hasn't been effective.
You fought in Iraq for four tours of duty. Why did you volunteer to keep going back? And in looking at this closure of this phase of the war, did you meet the goals that you set out for yourself?
You know, I went to Iraq because I wanted to serve this country and I wanted to serve with the young men and women who went over there with me. And that's what brought me back time and again. I didn't go because I voted for the policy or the president. That doesn't matter. To me, it was about serving and doing my part. And I'm glad that I went. I don't want to see my effort, to go in vain. I don't want to see the lives lost to have been lost in vain.
Is that happening?
I'm not sure. And I try to separate myself from that emotion. But it's hard. It's hard when you've seen, you know, friends and colleagues killed over there. You don't want to see those lives lost in vain. And I think that a lot of troops, you know, they wonder whether the politicians in Washington, you know, would be willing to stake their political futures, perhaps even sacrifice their political careers to do what is right for the war and for the country. Because 4,400 young Americans gave their entire lives for America and for the future of Iraq.
Seth Moulton is a former Marine who served four tours of duty in Iraq, working for many years for General David Petraeus. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
From the war in Iraq to the Middle East, President Obama takes his first stab at that difficult issue today. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas are in Washington to meet with the president. Tomorrow they will hold direct talks, the first face-to-face sessions between the Israelis and the Palestinians since December 2008. The talks come on the heels of yesterday's attack in the West Bank when four Israeli settlers were gunned down. The military wing of Hamas, the Islamic group that controls Gaza, claimed responsibility for that attack. Joining us to discuss the expectations for these talks is Ethan Bronner, Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times. Ethan, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you, Monica.
Ethan, first, what effect do you think this West Bank attack will have on the talks? And will Hamas be the spoilers of these negotiations?
I don't think that the attack will spoil the negotiations. It will have the effect of allowing Prime Minister Netanyahu to have something truly dramatic and brutal in his hand when he says to the Americans and to President Abbas of the Palestinian Authority, look, we have real security concerns. We cannot just walk away from the West Bank. Our soldiers need to be involved for an extended period of time. So in that sense, I think it will have an effect. But I don't think either side thought that Hamas was gone from the West Bank or that nobody would ever be killed again. And so what happened wouldn't end or ruin the talks.
But do you think Hamas may launch other attacks while these talks are ongoing to try to scuttle the negotiations?
I'm certain that Hamas will try, and it seems likely that on occasion they will succeed. But one of the things that has happened, at least seems to have happened, is that between the Israeli military and the Palestinian Authority security forces, they have the West Bank fairly well wired against Hamas. So I don't think that Hamas can do what it wants in the West Bank. I think that the fact that it can occasionally gun people down, we'll see how occasionally and how effectively. But I doubt that it's going to be a plague of any kind. That's my sense.
Well, the attack highlights the issue of settlements. And right now there's a partial moratorium on settlement construction in the West Bank, but that expires on September 26th. Is the settlement issue a deal breaker?
Well, it could be. It certainly has been for the last year and a half. The Palestinians have declined to join direct talks precisely because of the construction not being over, even though this moratorium has been in effect for the last mostly 9 months. It didn't affect East Jerusalem, and in advance of the moratorium, the Israelis did build kind of double what they had, so that it wasn't a really major stoppage of construction. Look, I think it's an enormously difficult problem for both sides. It, along with three or so other issues, are so difficult that 17 years of negotiations have not led to an agreement, even though the outlines of an agreement seem relatively clear to everybody.
What do you see are the possible compromise solutions to the settlement issue?
It's difficult for me to predict how they're going to square the circle on this one. The way Prime Minister Netanyahu has been talking is to say, we're going to put all of these difficult issues into a basket and we're going to negotiate all of them at once. I and the president of the Palestinian Authority are going to negotiate these very difficult issues, Jerusalem, settlements, borders, refugees, so that we're not going to put all of our political capital into just one issue and let that be a deal breaker. I don't know whether the Palestinian Authority president is signed up for the same process. I don't know whether he agrees that that's what's going to happen. But my guess is he has, because they've been talking about it through George Mitchell now for many months about how they'd proceed. So if President Abbas can stay in the talks beyond September 26th and some building occurs, then I think we can imagine a global deal, if you like, organized by the two of them. If Abbas feels that his honor and his the things that he said about settlement are so important that if the building recurs on September 26th and he walks out, then I don't know what will happen, because I don't think the Israelis, in fact, will extend the moratorium on the 26th of September.
Ethan Bronner is Jerusalem Bureau Chief for The New York Times. More with him after a break. And coming up later in the show, how one reporter's decades-long devotion to a soldier missing in action in Vietnam comes full circle. Back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. On the web at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation about the Middle East peace process, which resumes today and tomorrow at the White House. We're speaking with Ethan Bronner, Jerusalem Bureau Chief for The New York Times. And Ethan, before the break, you mentioned refugees. President Mahmoud Abbas has insisted that Palestinian refugees have the right of return to homes in what is Israel today. But many Israelis see that as ending the existence of the Jewish state. Where do you find room for compromise on that issue?
The right of return for the Palestinians, like on the other side, the desire for a unified Jerusalem under full Israeli sovereignty, are two points of great emotional import on each side that clearly are going to have to be exchanged one for the other. And I think that in previous rounds of negotiations, each side understood that. Mahmoud Abbas, I spoke with him 7 years ago when he came in as prime minister, when Arafat was still alive. And you know, he's from what is today Israel. And when we spoke at that time, he made clear to me that he doesn't expect to go back there and doesn't expect others to go back. But it is a very important right that can't be just yielded in advance. And I think that from the Israeli perspective, their control over Jerusalem is similar. So I can see those two being exchanged, one for the other.
Well, despite these issues on the table, you did write recently that the crude outlines of a Palestinian state are emerging in the West Bank. What are the signs you're seeing that it's really happening? What can you point to?
Well, there are a lot of things. The Palestinian security forces that I mentioned earlier are made up of some very, very professional people. There are 3,000 or 4,000 troops who have been trained in Jordan with American money and organization. The police in the West Bank have been undergoing an enormous amount of training with European cooperation. They have human rights training. So that's on the security side. And as I said, apart from the killing last night, there has been very little such violence of that nature in the last 2 years. So that's one very important thing. So people in the West Bank, in the cities of like Nablus and Hebron, which were run by gangs 2 years ago, really do have a sense of normality to their lives today. They stay out late at night. The economy has been growing quite steadily. All of those things together have given people a feeling that they're living inside a place that has some cohesion as a society. And the Israeli troops have pulled out of the cities and tend to only go into them at night to go after the kinds of guys who carried out the killing last night.
Yeah, leaving a lot of the daytime security to the Palestinian Authority.
That's right.
What about the internal politics on both sides with regards to these talks in Washington that are going to get underway tomorrow? Does Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu have any room to move politically on making a deal with the Palestinians?
The one thing that we do know is that Netanyahu is the most powerful prime minister in terms of popular support and a steady and stable coalition in many years in Israel. He has, in that sense, a great deal of room to maneuver. The question is, what will happen to those truly to his right if he were to do things that they would disapprove of regarding settlements in Jerusalem and borders? And, you know, we don't really know. But on the other hand, what we do know is that the opposition, which is led by Kadima, the center-left party, will back him in those things. They want a two-state solution. So in a lot of ways, he has room to maneuver. And there are those who believe because he comes from the right, there's a notion that peace in Israel can only be made by the right, because these are people with strong, hawkish credentials and credentials of a devotion to land, and yielding it is something that you do with great difficulty, as opposed to the left, which has been saying, give it up for 40 years.
Well, what about the splits on the Palestinian side between the Palestinian Authority and Hamas? How much do those divisions hamper the road to some sort of agreement?
The division between Hamas and Fatah is, Fatah is the dominant party of the Palestinian Authority, of President Abbas, is deeper every day. And one of the things that's so distressing for those who want to see a two-state solution about the killings last night, apart from the obvious brutality and bloodshed, is that it was clearly aimed at Abbas and the Palestinian Authority. The killing was really aimed at saying to them, you cannot control what's going on in the West Bank. We have maneuverability. So, and today, dozens and dozens of Hamas-related people or thought-to-be related people have been picked up by the Palestinian Authority police. So that division is quite, quite problematic. And by the way, it's not just that division. There are also factions to the left of Fatah that are object to these negotiations and that have held demonstrations and so on. So President Abbas is not a particularly powerful figure, and that's a big problem. One reason why many people who think that the talks are a bad idea or bound to fail have taken that point of view. In both societies, the argument is that there really is no choice other than a two-state solution. Most polls show that most people on both sides want that, and what's lacking is leadership to bring it about. And when it happens, people will follow. We'll see. We don't know if it'll happen, and we don't know if people will follow.
Well, why restart these talks now? Why do you believe President Obama's chosen, on the heels of pulling out of Iraq, to start this now? Is the U.S. trying to put together some sort of coalition of support in the Middle East?
Sure. From an American perspective, what has to happen in the Middle East is there has to be some way to resist a rising sense of Iranian hegemony and power seeking. That is the American fear that it could happen in Iraq, and it could happen in southern Lebanon, and it could happen in Gaza and the West Bank, and so on. And of course, there is the Iranian nuclear program, which the Americans believe is aimed at building a bomb. So for all these reasons, the idea is to diffuse this particular conflict and to get the Palestinians and Israelis, Egypt, Jordan, and so on one side with the Americans and possibly Syria, if the deal were to go forward, against what's happening from Iran. So certainly you're right that that is the way this administration views the need to move this forward, apart from the need on its own for a Palestinian state and for justice and decency for daily life among Palestinians.
Ethan Bronner is the Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times. Ethan, thanks for speaking with us.
It was my pleasure.
Still ahead today, book critic Gail Caldwell's memoir of her friendship with author Caroline Knapp. News is next here and now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Hinckley, Allen & Snyder, where partners have been giving clients practical legal advice for over 100 years throughout New England and now including Connecticut, online at haslaw.com. And the Institute of Contemporary Art on the Boston waterfront. Discover the power and beauty of new art and ideas, icaboston.org.
I'm Monica Brady-Meyerov, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Despite the worst oil spill in U.S. history, the 75th annual Shrimp and Petroleum Festival kicks off tomorrow in the small town of Morgan City, Louisiana, with parades, music, and of course, lots of shrimp. And you might be wondering, is this the best time to honor the oil industry? Well, that's not the thinking in Morgan City, which is also celebrating its 150th anniversary this year. Joining us on the line is Nelson Cortez, a longtime volunteer at the festival and a past festival king, too. And Nelson, I understand you've got a lot of questions about this from all over the world. You've talked to the BBC. How can you have a shrimp and petroleum festival in a year like this?
Very simply, we are in an area that was, as far as the oil spill was concerned, we were not directly affected by the spill itself. No oil made it to our area. We are 90 miles southwest of New Orleans. The two industries have operated cohesively in Morgan City since the mid-1960s, when the first offshore oil well was drilled right off the coast of Morgan City. And members of the shrimping industry at that time had boats that were capable of carrying supplies back and forth to these wells, and it has been that way since the first well was drilled off the coast of Morgan City.
And describe the festival's logo for us. This is radio, so give us a good description of what it looks like.
The festival's logo is an oil rig, which you would find in the Gulf of Mexico, with a large shrimp wrapped around it, wearing a hard hat, symboling the fact that the shrimp and the oil have been together cohesively for some 40-something years now.
And it's on the crown that the queen of the festival wears as well. What about you, when you won as king? Did you have a crown, too, for it?
The king's crown and the queen's crown both have the emblem logo in it, as well as the scepters that they carry for the evening of the coronation.
So it's easy to see how to honor shrimp at a festival like this. Food. Tell me about what you can eat at the festival.
You can find almost any type of seafood at the festival, starting with shrimp on a stick, shrimp stew and shrimp gumbo, fish, which is fried, as well as fish sandwiches of different types.
And I understand some alligator, too?
Yes. Alligator on a stick is very important. The tail meat of the alligator is very tender. It's very white.
Does it taste like chicken?
It does. It actually does. If you prepare it in the same type of seasoning and batter that you do to fry chicken, it's very much the same.
Well, how are you honoring the oil industry during this festival?
On the festival grounds itself, we have a cultural expo exhibit, and this shows the tools used on these rigs and how the exploration has changed. And we also will have one of the ROV vehicles that was used to cap the well, with recorded footage being shown while it was at work beneath the surface of the water.
but there isn't any petroleum-themed food or games, maybe, you know, wrestling in a pit of petroleum.
No, no. No, we don't do that.
Well, what do you look forward to most at the fair?
On festival weekend, what I'm most interested in, of course, is the mass in the park.
They hold a mass in the park?
Yes, and at that mass, the crowns that the king and queen wear, a platter of boiled shrimp, oil in some fashion, are presented at the beginning of the mass. That's a very special moment. And then, of course, later that evening, we will have a grand fireworks display.
Well, despite all the good-sounding shrimp dishes, I hear that the fair burgers are what a lot of people look forward to.
Yeah, the local people look for one particular booth, which is a volunteer group for a local Catholic school. These people are infamous now for their hamburgers and grilled onions, and they are on the corner of 3rd and Everett Street, and they almost have like a drive-through. If you have a person that's working in the booth's cell phone number, you can call an order, pass by, hand them money, and they'll give you a box with your burgers in it.
That's,
go on your way.
That's convenient.
Yes, it is.
Well, wish we could stop by.
I wish you could also.
Nelson Cortez is a longtime volunteer and former king at the 75th Shrimp and Petroleum Festival that's being held in Morgan City, Louisiana, this weekend. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
We'll be back in just 30 seconds. It's Here and Now. Thirty-five years after the official end to the Vietnam War, there are nearly 2,000 Americans who fought in that war that are still listed as missing in action or unaccounted for. But every once in a while, remains are found, and a family that spent decades wondering finally has answers. Such was the case recently with First Lieutenant Paul Majors from Billings, Montana. He'd been in Vietnam for only 2 weeks when his helicopter went down in 1971. Originally listed as killed in action, body not recovered. But last summer, Paul Majors' remains were found and identified earlier this year. Funeral and memorial services were held last week in Billings, attended by Lieutenant Majors' former high school classmates, Army buddies, siblings, and his 92-year-old mother. Also in attendance was Kurt Nickisch. Kurt is a reporter for Here and Now's home station, WBUR, in Boston, but he wasn't there for a work assignment. He never met Paul Majors, but he wondered about him all the time for the last 25 years. Kurt joins us from the studios of South Dakota Public Radio. Hi, Kurt.
Hi, Monica.
Kurt, you were a self-described Army brat growing up, and you were in middle school when Paul Majors came into your life. Explain how.
Well, I knew somebody who wore one of these POW/MIA bracelets, these sort of metal bracelets that has the name and service and theater of operations and the date of missing in action for that soldier. And my sister and I were so impressed by this that we both decided to get one. We got two different folks by chance. She got someone else. I got Paul Majors. And so for the last 20-something years, I have kept that bracelet as sort of a personal pledge to remember him and honor his service and hope for his return.
How did you find out that Lieutenant Major's remains had been identified?
Well, I had always kind of followed these stories because I knew that, you know, with better relations with Vietnam, some teams had been able to go in and try to visit crash sites or battle sites and try to recover remains. And just a few weeks ago, I was just stunned to read this news story and find out that Paul Majors was coming home.
What compelled you to go out to Montana to attend his service?
You know, I called my sister that morning, and I was just so happy to tell her that he was coming home. And the first thing she said to me was, "Are you going to go?" And it just seemed so natural to go and to remember and sort of honor the service of somebody who you know, who'd been gone for so long.
What did you say at the service?
So I told them the story of the bracelet, and I said that, you know, it was a personal pledge I made. I'm so glad he's coming home, and I couldn't thank him for what he did, but I could thank them. And I said I wanted to give the bracelet to them, and I gave it to his mother, Cecilia Majors, 92 years old.
And how did they respond?
They were really touched by it, and it was really, really heartwarming for me to be received so well. They just thought it was so amazing that somebody would keep and remember Paul for all these years without really knowing them. So his mom told me she would treasure the bracelet, and the fact that I made the trip, it just meant a lot to them. And it was such a privilege for me to get to see them remember him, because they told stories. I saw photos and home movies that were taken back then, and I got a better sense of the person whose name I'd been carrying all these years.
Kurt Nickisch is a reporter for WBUR Radio in Boston, where Here and Now is produced. He's speaking to us from South Dakota Public Radio. Kurt, thank you very much for talking with us about this.
Sure thing.
An enduring bond also underlies the next story. Robin Young is off today, but she left us this conversation about friendship.
In the mid-90s, Gail Caldwell was an acclaimed book critic for the Boston Globe. She'd go on to win the Pulitzer. Caroline Knapp was a hugely popular columnist for the Boston Phoenix, who'd write two best-selling memoirs, Drinking, a Love Story, and Pack of Two, about her dog. Both women loved their dogs ferociously. Both had stared down alcoholism. Both coveted the solitary life of a writer. Gail took breaks to swim. Caroline rode. They were both between relationships with men, and each seemed to care more about what went on in her head than the long mane of unruly hair atop it. A lot of women of a certain age and aspiration would have wanted to be friends with either woman, but lucky them, they found each other.
The friendship must have announced its depth by its obvious affection, but also by our similarities, muted or apparent. That our life stories had wound their way toward each other on corresponding paths was part of the early connection. Finding Caroline was like placing a personal ad for an imaginary friend, then having her show up at your door funnier and better than you had conceived. Apart, we had each been frightened drunks and aspiring writers and dog lovers. Together, we became a small corporation.
But it wasn't to last. Caroline Knapp died of lung cancer in 2002 at the age of 42. And now Gail Caldwell has written a memoir of their friendship in the new book, Let's Take the Long Way Home. She joins us in the studio. Gail, you know, it's been 8 years. But still, I feel I want to say so sorry.
Oh, thank you, Robin.
And what a read. You say people mistook you for sisters, for lovers. You were neither. You were friends. Just what did that mean?
I think I said somewhere that writing about us was like trying to capture air, because so much of it was this sort of blissful routine of an ordinary life. We walked. We talked. We talked about the dogs. We walked the dogs. We went home and called each other on the phone and walked some more.
In fact, the title of the book, Let's Take the Long Way Home, came from something Caroline used to say to you, let's take the long way home so we can talk more.
Yeah, we used to go to the woods for hours, and we'd get in the car and she would look at me and go, let's take the long way home, because we couldn't bear to stop whatever we were doing.
Yeah.
You know, the things that connected us, in fact, as our friendship unfolded and became more intimate and more intense, we realized that we had these uncanny parallels that had nothing to do with our upbringing or our histories, but everything to do with our sensibility.
And what about it was uniquely female? At one point, another friend says something about female friendships. If guys found out, we shouldn't let them find out what this
I
is.
I love that line. Yes, my friend Louise, I said, men don't really understand women's friendships, do they? And she said, oh, no, and we must never tell them.
Tell them what?
Well, you know, a friend actually said to me, to my surprise, that she thought this was a gender-free relationship. I think because of the a lot of what we did was about sports and being outside and competing with each other, which I think women have been taught not to do before they can talk. And I think we wanted to and did defy a lot of gender stereotypes. But I also think that the emotionality and straightforward intimacy between us, at least in my experience, is much more reliably female than male.
We'll have more of Robin Young's conversation with Gail Caldwell. Her book is a memoir of her friendship with the late author Caroline Knapp. Back in a minute, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Welcome back. I'm Monica Brady-Myrov, in for Robin Young, with more of Robin's conversation with Gail Caldwell about her deep friendship with author Caroline Knapp. That's not a euphemism. The two were between boyfriends when they met. Caroline would marry one before she died suddenly at the age of 42 from cancer. Before that, the two women shared their love of dogs, the outdoors, and writing. In her memoir of those times called Let's Take the Long Way Home, Gail confesses that she, the older acclaimed book critic, actually got a little ticked at her author friend because she never commented on her writing. When she asked Gail about it, Caroline was equally flustered. She assumed Gail knew how much she admired her. And in that moment, the previously fiercely self-reliant Gail Caldwell had a realization.
I had needed her to like my writing, to give me reassurance, to be there for to all the things that we want from somebody who we depend on. And I think that she was mortified that she had not said anything to me, and she was appalled at her reserved silence. And then my response was, oh, my God, it turns out I need you. Yeah. What a horrifying thought. Because each of us had spent a lot of years erecting a pretty solitary life.
Well, but that's what you were in each other's lives for, to be able to say that sentence.
Mm.
But her writing, you know, as a book critic, we have some of it right. I mean, just, if this is from Drinking a Love Story. A love story, yes, this is a love story. It's about passion, sensual pleasure, deep pulls, lust, fears, yearning hungers. As you write, you know, before her, writing about drinking had been the men's arena.
Absolutely. And, you know, when I read Drinking a Love Story, we were not yet friends. I knew her. I had met her, but our friendship hadn't begun. What I remember reading that in reading the book was thinking, oh, my God, this is the first time a woman has told the truth about what it's like to be a high-functioning alcoholic. And in fact, I mean, Caroline was fearless in front of a keyboard. I was laughing the other day and saying to a friend, she was the shyest person in a crowd of three or more. She was unbelievably shy, but you put her in front of a keyboard and she was completely courageous and would walk toward the fire. So I had always admired that about her. We were very different in terms of what we wrote about and I think the way we approached it. And I think we learned a lot from each other for that reason.
She was also one of the first to write about a love affair with a dog, which, you know, that now that's sort of become a genre, you know, but
right.
Her Pack of Two was one of the first. So the dogs.
The dogs.
Oh,
and I have to say, my former beautiful Clementine, who was my great canine love, is given the nom de plume of Oakley in Caroline's Pack of Two.
Yeah.
So we appeared under different names, which still amuses me.
Well, Clementine, your dog, Lucille, hers, they're sort of the silent Greek chorus here. What did they do for you?
Sometimes not so silent. They were the glue in a whole lot of ways. I mean, yes, that's a lovely way to see it. We both had puppies at the same time, and I think that we had that new mom in the park sensibility. We reached toward each other because we understood what the other one was going through. And it was so enriching and rewarding, it being the canine experience for each of us, that when we recognized that in the other, we went from being these parallel dyads of women with their dogs to a pack of four.
You know, it occurs as we read, and you even acknowledge it at one point, that what you're writing about is a form of family that many people will be familiar with. It's made up of friends, former boyfriends, Caroline, before she dies, marries her longtime boyfriend. It's not the nuclear family that we think of, but still, you know, people have each other's house keys and emergency numbers.
Right, right. Well, I think that family, nuclear families have become so atomized in the last generation. And also, Caroline and I neither had children, neither had married, though she was, in fact, involved the majority of the time with the man she would later marry.
Morelli.
And I think that this is probably, if you're lucky, more common than we give it credibility for, certainly, which is that we choose the people in the inner circle who we depend upon emotionally and then at a certain point in life logistically. I mean, Caroline and I used to laugh for years that I would say, oh, my God, I forgot to get married, or I forgot this. And then I'd say, what am I going to do when I'm old and I can't? And whatever it was, Caroline would say, don't worry, I'm going to make you soup. And I would laugh and say, but you can't cook. But she was 9 years the younger, and so we had this idea that we always did have each other's back.
When does it become easier, maybe even possible, when does it become possible to go back on the same walks, to row in the same river? When does that become possible?
You know, some of it became healing from the beginning, which is to say, because Caroline had taught me to row and we shared the river had become a background character in both our lives. And when I say I still look for her, that I don't mean that in that haunted way of imagining that she might be there. I will always be able to see her form on the river. I hope I will always be able to see it. And from the time that she was gone, I went back to the river because it was the one place where I felt like I could talk to her. There are some places that are forever changed. And, you know, it's funny. I know somebody who was describing anniversaries and saying, well, the anniversary always sneaks up on you, or an anniversary of a loss is always more difficult. And the fact is that I think the more deeply ingrained somebody is in the daily aspects of your life, the more rituals you have to choose from to mourn. And in fact, so Caroline lived in my head and heart and on a daily routine in my life so much that there weren't many places I could go that didn't remind me of her. So it's like water seeking its own level. At some point, it just is what it is.
Yeah.
And the loss becomes your accompanying atmosphere, if you will.
Well, we're not going to give away the ending because I will sob like I did when I got to it. But what do you say to people who have lost a best friend two or four-footed?
Oh, God. I think I've spent a lot of years learning what not to say. Or rather, that there are gestures and silences that can be as meaningful as anything that I might say. I feel humbled by grief and the power and the length of it. I also, I can say this many years later, I feel honored to have loved somebody enough to have my heart broken. I think it takes a lifetime to be able to figure that out and to bear it.
Book critic and memoirist Gail Caldwell writes about her friendship with the late author Caroline Knapp in Gail's book, Let's Take the Long Way Home, A Memoir of Friendship. Gail, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin. I'm so glad to be here. Thank you.